artificial intelligence is capable of identifying the source of the sounds, the source of the gram, and they have a couple of hundreds of miles at least to follow them all the way to the border. They've done similar things very effectively, and we do have leverage over Egypt. Egypt also can do things that Israel cannot. The international community and all the Arab world would not let Israel do things that Egypt can do. As a matter of fact, there was a solution to the border when Israel was there that Egypt, that they discussed with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians were against it. And it's possible that they're going to use it themselves now.
Is there a question in here?
We have trained the senior Egyptians intelligence officers here in the States, and they are extremely capable.
Are you? I'm asking, I would really would like questions. I mean, if do you have a question, or is this is a comment you'd like someone up here to address?
Why don't we use our leverage against Egypt?
Okay, are you directing it to anybody up here, or just... Dave. All right, so David, this you'll take that one. Yes, Jim. It's on the table.
Jerome Siegel, University of Maryland. It seemed to me that... that the whole discussion skirted, I guess, what I think is the key issue, which is really Hamas's stake or absence of a stake in a peace process. I think the idea that you can buy, and I'll make a comment, I like Dennis and David or anyone who wants to respond to it, but the comment is this, the idea that I think that you can, as it were, get a peace process by focusing just on short-term issues of calm and that Hamas will just let this go independent of whether or not it has a stake in the peace process, I think is a big misconception. And the big question as to whether or not Hamas has a stake in the peace process is whether or not if there's a Palestinian state, if Hamas wins an election, will it be allowed to rule? Now, Hamas's experience and certainly its interpretation of its experience is that the United States, Israel, and Fatah conspired together to prevent it from ruling after it won the election. And my belief is that unless you take deliberate steps to reverse the perception of what the future will hold, if there is a Palestinian state, then Hamas will dedicate itself to preventing that. I think it can be done by moving away from the ideological conditions that were associated with the quartet and replacing them with one procedural condition, which is simply that if there is a state, that any successor government in that state has to treat a ratified treaty as binding international law. And the issue of ratification will go back to the Fatah-Hamas agreement, not Mecca, but basically in the prisoners' document about ratification. I don't think reform PLO is in the works. But I think if you have that, Hamas can be brought on board procedurally, but you have to make an effort to do it. And that means really making a decision that we made a big mistake, that all three of those parties made a big mistake by not letting Hamas rule, and that's what has to be reversed for the future.
Raith, I'll let you take that one. Yeah. Dr. Friedman.
Yeah. Bob Friedman, Johns Hopkins. Yesterday, at which they wrote, the government did nothing. Today, it's Ashkelon. The government hasn't done anything. Tomorrow, maybe Tel Aviv. So I'm just raising a question with how long in everybody's mind the government of Israel can wait until the problem gets too bad. And doesn't it make more sense for the Israelis, whatever the world cost is, to go in now to prevent more rockets on Ashkelon and future rockets on Tel Aviv? And I think that's a necessity rather than, I might say, waiting for the accident. I think the accident's already happened.
Jim, I'll let you deal with that one, okay? All right, so David, why don't you take size, and then Raith will take Jerome's, and Jim will take Bob's.
Okay. Look, to size point about the U.S. leverage, I think, yes, the U.S. does have leverage. It's a very extensive relationship. Egypt is a very close ally of the United States, and therefore, you know, the United States has sent, you know, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and technology now to deal with this issue of the border. But like I tried to say in my remarks, you know, I don't think it's enough because There's the issue of the maritime, that the stuff is coming in on boats and ships, and you need to intercept it way before it gets to the goalie. My only hope is that Egypt, given what it just experienced with Hamas breaking down the barrier, means it's clear that Egypt wants everything we hear. Egypt definitely wants a ceasefire, but Egypt should have more of an interest because this, you know, the people, the rockets might be going one way in, but the people are going the other way too. So I think the United States has to see this as a major priority, and it's not just about the border. It's about intercepting it much deeper in Sinai. My understanding is that there's only a few main arteries in Sinai. Now, you could say, well, the Bedouins are becoming radicalized and all this, but I think that if Egypt saw this as a national security challenge to stop this farther out, I think, and the maritime issue, I think you need a multi-layer approach. And I want to be very careful here that I am not saying at all, because we might have some Egyptian officials here too, I'm not saying Egypt is stiffing the United States or stiffing Israel, but I'm just saying that this needs to have high-level attention, and there has to be not just Suleiman and Amos Gilad, but you need military to military, Barak, Tantawi. This has got to be a major national priority, because my fear is the following side. Right now what's happening is that Hamas is playing the Egyptians off against the Israelis. And they would love it. For them, it would be fabulous if the nature of all this means that the Egyptian-Israeli relationship deteriorates and that there's pressure on the treaty and would unravel. So I certainly think the Egyptians have an interest also in Annapolis succeeding, and I think they understand also that if Annapolis fails, this issue is going to probably heat up much more. So I think Egypt does have an interest. And I think we should do whatever we can to facilitate a trilateral approach with Egypt and Israel working hand in glove on not just the border, but farther beyond that. Thank you.
I think what it takes for Hamas to have a political stake in the process has been very clearly spelled out. Accepting the two-state solution is the first concept. Because if Hamas does not accept the two-state solution, what is there to talk to them about? If they don't accept the premise, I'm not saying accept Geneva or accept the Paris Protocol, but the very basic premise. What they're trying to do, in my view, what Hamas is trying to do is to win it on both sides. On the one hand, they want to get political cred, by domestic cred, by saying we're the resistance, we're the true nationalists, etc., etc., and continuing the resistance discourse and the terrorist action that comes with it, on the one hand. On the other hand, they're trying to also get international recognition and gain the foreign policy game. If we allow this to happen, I think they will have no incentive whatsoever to behave responsibly. And this is, again, where that's the one side of what it takes to get them a political stake. The second one is the issue of relinquishing their armament. At the end of the day, Hamas might say, yes, fine, we'll accept the rules of the game. But what we saw from them is that when things don't run their way, they immediately go back and start shooting. What is there to guarantee to us that once they accept this, once they take the political gain from being mainstreamed and things don't move their way, they would not use weapons again? And we saw this in June. Egypt paid the price for this recently. Egypt thought with this live and let live that Hamas is going to act responsibly. No, they're not going to act responsibly. So in that sense, there are some very basic requirements for participation. Just one quick point, if I may, on the last question. Why shouldn't Israel step in right now? The problem that we're seeing right now is Israel is using military power not as a strategic tool, but as a public opinion management tool. And that is very, very dangerous. I think that if Israel believed that they can achieve the objectives using military force, they would have done that a long time ago, but it's much more complicated.
The question of how long Israel can wait, really, it has to do with two things as I see it. The first one is militarily. And militarily, the longer you wait, the more difficult it is. The material that comes in is not only rockets. The material that's come in is also designed to protect Gaza from an Israeli attack. And as I think as David mentioned, one of the first places Israelis would be going would be along the border. They would want to cut off the rest of Gaza from the ability to receive things through tunnels. So I think, yes, probably right. That's probably where they would go first. I don't think they would be limited to that, but I think that's where they would start. But Hamas is not foolish, and they see that as well. And I'm sure they're making extensive efforts to make whatever Israeli attack along the border with Egypt, whatever occurs, as difficult as possible for the Israelis. So militarily speaking, if you're looking for a military solution, the sooner you operate, the better, obviously. The problem is that it's not only a military problem. It's also a political problem for the Israelis. It's political internal, which brings up exactly what Dennis said. Things can change dramatically very quickly. As soon as the school is hit and 40 children are cut to shreds, there will be some sort of an action. One assumes that the IDF has already planned what it will do when it gets the order to react. But there's also that's the internal political pressure, which becomes really very difficult for Israeli governments. As Ray said, many things that the Israelis have done in the past militarily have not been really military. They've been designed as sops for internal consumption. When I lived in Gaza, at the beginning of the Intifada, the Israelis used to bomb the police barracks. They would always wait till the evening. Everybody knew that with the bomb in the evening, so everybody get out of the police barracks, nobody would be hurt. And eventually they reduced it to rubble, but then they would still bomb it, and they would move the rubble a little bit here, a little bit there, but the rubble was just being moved around. That was a reaction to suicide bombing. They had to do something, so they bombed Gaza, but not wanting to go so far as to kill a whole lot of people. So they simply bomb symbolic targets again and again. There's external political difficulties too, of course, because when the Israelis go in, it's inevitable, I would say by design, on the Hamas side. And really, it's not. I don't mean to demonize Hamas particularly, because this is a characteristic of any sort of revolutionary movement. It's going to have to sacrifice in asymmetrical warfare. You would have to sacrifice civilians to make up for the fact that you don't have tanks and F-16s and so on. But when the Israelis go in, they will inevitably, and I think Dennis also mentioned this, they're going to kill a lot of civilians because it's going to either be by accident or by design on the part of the Hamas people. They use people as shields because that's what they have. And that raises a very great difficulty with various parts of the international community. The most recent incursion, you had all kinds of discussions about how it was disproportionate. And how they would know that, I can't know. But apparently it was simply based upon the number of civilians killed. The Europeans and the United Nations said that this was disproportionate. What's disproportionate in war is not defined by how many civilians are killed. Actually, it's defined by why they're killed, whether or not the military target was of sufficient importance to justify the fact that some civilians might be killed, and how many civilians you knew were going to be killed when you attacked it, or you suspected, or you reasonably could have suspected. There's a lot of factors that go into that. But the truth is that, as you saw in the most recent incursion, regardless of what the facts are, if a lot of civilians are killed, the Israelis will be condemned for committing a disproportionate behavior, which indeed they would argue is a war crime. So I think it's very difficult for the Israelis to decide what to do. And I think that, as Dennis suggested, I think they're ready to go. And as Dennis suggested, when they have the right trigger, they will. Everybody says, well, gee, isn't that kind of terrible? You're waiting for 40 kids to get killed before you do something. But the political realities, I think the Israeli state feels that the political realities are such that it has to do that.
Okay, we got time for one more round. We'll go here, then Paul and Haim and Marvin. Okay, we'll do four in this round.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, the Washington Times, and my question is to Guy Avery. If I understood you right, you argue that Hamas lost its popularity among the Palestinian population within the last 10 days or 2 weeks. That's the first one. And the second one, you're advising against engaging Hamas. And and narrowly speaking, put aside, you know, the foreign powers, the, you know, neighboring countries, the Arab states and whatnot, what gives you the courage that Hamas at this time will recognize the two-state solution or the right, you know, for Israel to exist? What is it that you see is taking place in the Palestinian Authority, among the Palestinian people, that you're advising not to engage with Hamas? Thank you.
Paul.
In some ways, opposite this side, this is primarily to David and Leith. The question that I have is the longer-term relationship with Hamas, building up on what Jerome Siegel said, given that if the scenario that you sketched out, Dennis, that I think is realistic as a possibility, if you can have a truce arranged, what then? How do you bring Hamas in? And it seems to me what Leib said, demanding the recognition of the demand, as desirable as that is, seems to me unrealistic. Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. It has an international constituency. It's not going to change itself formally. The question is, put it back to where it was? It did not really, as most of us seen, it did not intend to win the elections in 2006. If there was anything to the Vanity Fair article, there was a coup against it in 2007. I mean, I'm sure that was overblown, but that may have explained what happened in June. So the question is, can they come back into a government even without accepting the conditions? And if they don't, what is the other solution? Delegitimization, I don't see how that will work. Leith suggested targeting them. I'm not sure how you can target them without targeting all the people.
That's me.
Yeah.
Okay. I think Marvin, yeah.
My question is, what do we know about the U.S. attitude toward the likelihood of an Israeli movement to Gaza? Is it doing everything in its power to stop it? Does it feel it's inevitable? And then what are the limits? You spoke about giving them some leeway or not too much leeway. What is your understanding of what's going on?
Okay, and last one is Haim.
My question to you is, can Fatah be in there? And what does it take for Fatah to be able to deliver in the background of what happened in summer 2006? What do you think about the idea regarding Marwan Barghouti, the idea that Benjamin Ben-Eliezer is pushing?
So what we're going to do, since we have only 5 minutes left, I'm going to let each of us pick whichever questions of those that they want to respond to. Start, Race, we'll just go straight down here to Jim, and then I'll wrap up.
I think Hamas is losing popularity, but I don't think that it matters. In many ways. I mean, they're losing popularity but consolidating power. And there are many examples from the region where you can be unpopular still having a lot of power. I guess I'll bring a few questions together here. Why am I so against engaging Hamas? I think we're at a moment right now in the Palestinian national development whereby we're in a zero-sum game. We're at a cross point. Either Hamas wins, and by the way, neither Hamas or Fatah are in a mood to share power. One of them wants to destroy the other, and this is where we are right now. One of them will win. As far as I'm concerned, if Hamas wins, two things will happen. First of all, for our domestic purposes, Palestinian domestic purposes, we're going to have a theocracy that I'm not very comfortable having. In foreign policy terms, maybe Hamas will do what the PLO did and take 15 years to change its position and finally accept the two-state solution. I'm not sure I want to wait for 15 years. Give it, I mean, put this in a regional context where there is a big competition between radical Islam and the more moderate forces, this might have ripple effects. That's what I feel very strongly about it. And that's what I feel that Hamas has to meet these conditions. not as a technicality or what have you, but they have to pay the political price for coming into the political game. Otherwise, the message we're sending is, do whatever you want to do, you will gain politically, and you can still operate with impunity. That's my concern. In terms of Fatah, Vanity Fair article, first of all, I think is overly exaggerated, and look at the facts, they don't support the conclusions. But that's a different story. Can Fatah deliver? Depends what you wanted to deliver. Can Fatah become an accountable, agile political party? No. It will take a long, long, long time to do that. Can Fatah deliver the minimum in terms of security and basic levels of management and governance? I think they can, especially if there's pressure. And we see this right now. Salam Fayyad is there, and there's a clear indication from the world that if Salam goes, the money goes as well. So Fatah finds itself having to shape up. So we have to define for the short term what we want from Fatah. Marwan Barghouti, I think, would be a very good addition in that he will bring energy and he will bring a new blood. But the problem with Fatah is structural. And I always am very suspicious of knights in shining armor coming to save the day. Marwan will be very helpful if he is employed in a political context in the right way and not being brought in as a magic solution.
Okay, very quickly. Look, the whole issue of the proportionality, I don't know if someone mentioned it, I think is a very problematic term. I mean, Hamas is firing indiscriminately on the Israeli public. Is proportionality meaning Israel should fire just as indiscriminately into Gaza? It's interesting how that phrase has gained some sort of currency. I would say, Dennis and I usually agree. We actually agree on the submarine, Dennis, because I myself said that this isn't an Oslo situation where you can insulate the talks from what's going on the ground. I think, though, the threshold is not 40 kids getting killed or a thing in Ashkelon. It's all contextual. It's situational. When the more these rockets, they have a lot of them. They're going further and further to get to Bob Friedman's point. And I could very well see the IDF saying, got to cut it off now before it gets worse. So I don't think that's necessarily the trigger point. That really relates to Marvin's question about what is the U.S. advising Israel. I would assume what Rice was doing in Egypt, like I was saying at my start of my remarks, is to de-escalate the situation by coming up with this formula that nobody's negotiating with anybody, but somebody just suddenly stops firing and then somebody doesn't have to retaliate. I think because, based on the whole question of the submarine issue, that I think these talks are not invulnerable on Annapolis. So if this blows up, Annapolis could easily blow up. So I would think the United States certainly doesn't want that. And therefore, it's going to come down on the side of trying to not of restraint. And just on the engagement of Hamas issue, I should say that Tuesday we're having part two of this, the debate of the Robs, Sadloff Menmali. It's not about should the U.S. engage Hamas. I want to be very careful. No one is here advocating that on that next debate. But it's how to deal with Jerome's question. So come to part two. I personally come down closer to Wraith, which is that if you engage Hamas, you undermine the moderates. You put pressure on peace treaties ultimately because each of these countries, like Jordan and Egypt, each has Muslim brotherhoods. And if a Hudna is good enough, then who needs these treaties? And if you have unconditional talks, basically, then there's no incentive to change. Those are just three of the reasons off the top of the bat that I think that's problematic. So I'll stop right there.
Are there any questions left that haven't been answered?
No, if there's any final comments you want to make.
With Marwan Barghouti, the difficulty is that, my impression at least, is that he is less likely to be compromising than our Fayyad and Abbas in what is already a very difficult deal to reach a compromise. So I would not think that his participation would further the peace process at any great length, although there's a lot of support for him. So he might be able to better affect an agreement that was reached, but I think he would be less likely to reach one. And I agree with that Hamas is not likely to change its spots. It doesn't anytime very quickly. I think that's whistling in the dark. And I don't know what the Americans are advising. I'm not plugged into the Americans. Thank you.
First, I want to clarify one thing that David said. The debate of the Robs is actually on Wednesday. You're welcome to come Tuesday, but you won't hear anything then. Secondly, I would just say that the issue of Hamas obviously isn't going to go away. And the questions that are being raised relate to do you engage them, do you don't engage them. What you're hearing from the people up here is the high cost of any kind of even indirect engagement at this point. Not so that you couldn't do a de-escalation scenario, but that with Hamas wanting to demonstrate that the world must adjust to it and not the other way around, if what you're doing is coming up with an approach that is designed to show that everyone has to adjust to Hamas, you're going to pay a price. Now, Jerome, your approach is actually a little different because you're basically saying get away from any discussion of the politics and just simply say that whoever gets elected will be recognized, and which is a way to approach it. What I would have preferred the administration to have done prior to the elections, and actually I proposed it, but they were able to restrain their enthusiasm for this proposal, was twofold. First, having been someone who actually negotiated the interim agreement, which created a set of criteria for who could be a candidate, why we didn't stand by an agreement that we signed is still beyond me. But we didn't, and that created its own set of consequences. The other thing I would have liked to have done is to say, and this should apply, I think, in any case. I mean, I honestly believe that, you know, if you go throughout the rest of the world, there are kinds of conditions for who gets to run in elections. But putting that to the side, you know, I think it's perfectly appropriate that people understand that they can elect whomever they want, but also that why does that mean that we lose our own choice? We still have certain values, and we can choose to deal with who we will choose to deal with based upon who they are. Now, the problem is the administration didn't say that. What the administration needed to do in advance of the elections was to say Palestinians are free to elect whomever they want. But that doesn't mean that we lose our capacity to decide to whom we will deal with. Anyone who doesn't believe in coexistence and who believes in violence is not a suitable partner for us. I often am asked, or I often hear the issue in terms of Northern Ireland. You know, why can't you approach things the way it was done with the IRA? And I say, you know, go back and actually look at the record. What is it that Sinn Féin did before you were actually able to launch negotiations? Well, they accepted a political solution, they accepted a renunciation of violence, and they accepted decommissioning of weapons as a principle, not a timing, but a principle. And I would suggest if Hamas is prepared to accept any of that, then that changes who they are. One last point on Hamas. And this gets back to the whole issue of if you're going to have a ceasefire. One thing that Hamas has never done is make any effort to stop resistance. Because it's for them, it's part of who they are. It defines who they are. I had a conversation in the summer of 2005, July of 2005. I was in Gaza. And it happened to be the day after a bombing in Netanya. And I was meeting with Ziad Abu Amr, who is someone who has always been a Palestinian reformer, Democrat, also the conduit for Abu Mazen to Hamas. And I said, I just don't get it. Now, this was in July 2005, right after Abu Mazen had postponed the elections from the summer until January 2006. I said, I don't get it because I understand that for Hamas, the elections are a strategic objective. Because once there's elections, it's going to transform their position. They will become an arbiter of the Palestinian Authority. I wasn't saying I knew exactly what was going to happen in terms of what their vote was, but I knew the net result of the elections would be it would make them an arbiter of the Palestinian Authority. So I said, I do not get why they would, you know, allow bombs to go off now, because if this continues, the Israelis will basically make it impossible to hold elections. And so I said to Ziad, I said, so why is that? Can you explain this? He said, it's funny you ask, because he happened to see Mahmoud Zahar right after the previous afternoon, right after the bombing. And he asked him the question I posed to him, and he said, Zahar said the elections are strategic interest, but he said, but resistance, we can't stop resistance. That's against who we are. We can't stop resistance. So if someone wants to carry out resistance, that's okay. So there can't be any kind of truce ceasefire if it's like 2003, 2005, where they say, we as an organization respect it, but of course everybody else is free to carry it out. And any kind of deal would have to be written in that all stop. My guess of what Hamas will actually try to do, if you try to do this, is, every week or so you can have a few rockets, and that ought to, you should allow that. No, it should be understood. That happens, the crossing points close. And that's the way you get at the issue of who bears responsibility. It isn't just a charge. You make it part of any understanding. Now, all that doesn't necessarily solve the Hamas problem. In effect, if you listen closely to Raith, and this will be the last comment, Raith was basically saying, create a context where there's a choice for the Palestinian people over time. One pathway is you can achieve your national aspirations. The other pathway is you don't have national aspirations. You're part of the Ummah. And that too, these are the different futures. One is Islamic State, one is a national state. And that doesn't promise you, and I'll quote Raith, a quick fix. Because there isn't a quick fix on Hamas. You can't wish them away. But by the way, there's no quick fix by talking to them either, because of the effect it will have. All right, I want to thank all three panelists who I thought gave very interesting presentations and allowed you to get at least a perspective on what are some of the choices that we continue to face with regard to Gaza. Thank you very much for coming.